May it please the court, Mr. Russell. Respondent's conduct in this discipline case involved essential duties that he owed to safekeep his client's property, to diligently represent his clients, to reasonably communicate with his clients, and to charge reasonable fees. He failed to fulfill those duties on numerous occasions. The extent and seriousness of respondent's ethical misconduct is largely undisputed. Respondent owned three trust accounts during the relevant time period, one at First Bank of Missouri, one at Citizens Bank, and one at Farmers Bank. Between May of 2013 and February of 2015, the informant received 10 overdraft notifications regarding these trust accounts. The informant's financial investigator testified at the hearing before the disciplinary hearing panel that this was the most overdraft notifications that she had seen against one attorney in such a short period of time. Informant conducted an extensive two-year audit of respondent's trust accounts and determined the following. All three of those accounts were being used by respondent inappropriately. During the audit period, respondent made 225 inappropriate cash or internet withdrawals totaling $244,000 from the First Bank and Farmers Trust accounts. Many of these cash withdrawals occurred at ATMs located at or near gambling casinos. A significant amount of the money represented clients' advanced fee payments that were not yet earned by respondent. This conduct constituted the misappropriation of client funds that did not belong to the respondent in violation of Rule 4-1.15 for failing to safekeep client property and engaging in dishonest and deceitful conduct in violation of Rule 4-8.4C. Respondent also commingled personal funds with client funds in the trust account during this period in violation of the safekeeping property rule. Specifically, he deposited approximately $103,000 of personal funds from his operating and personal bank accounts into his trust account. He failed to maintain required trust account records, including client ledgers, billing statements, receipts in violation of Rule 4-1.15F. The failure to provide these bank records to the informant during its audit made it impossible to, if not extremely difficult, if not impossible, to accurately determine the amount of client funds misappropriated by the respondent from clients' advanced fee payments. He failed during the investigative process to cooperate with the informant's lawful demands for information in violation of Rule 4-8.1C. In addition to the trust account violations, he engaged in additional instances of serious misconduct with regard to the representation of numerous clients. Specifically, the record evidence established that respondent represented five separate clients on various legal matters, and in each case, the clients remitted an advanced fee payment ranging from $350 to $3,000. In each case, respondent neglected the legal matter, failed to communicate, failed to refund unearned portions of any advanced fee payments after the clients terminated the representation, and in one case, respondents sent inappropriate text messages to a female client. Respondent's conduct violated 4-1.3 for his lack of diligence, 4-1.4 for lack of communication, 4-1.5 for charging an unreasonable fee to these five clients, and 4-8.4D for conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice.
Have you totaled up the total amount of fees that he owes clients?
We have not, Your Honor. The fact is that because we were unable to get all the client records we needed, it was next to impossible to determine what he owed the clients. I can tell you that one client at least filed a small claims action, got a judgment against the respondent for his failure to refund money to her, but that was a small amount, about $1,000. It's very difficult for us to determine how much is owed back to clients, because respondent failed to have the records that we needed to make that determination.
So you have some evidence there was some amount, or you just don't know?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that there was misappropriation of advanced fee payments by the respondent during this relevant time period. We just don't know the exact amount. He was putting his own money into the trust account, $103,000, pulling out $244,000 from those trust accounts. Clearly, there was client money involved. We just were not able to put our finger on it, the exact amount. The disciplinary hearing panel found violations of various rules, as I've stated, as I've indicated. They did not find a violation of 4-8.4C for deceitful and dishonest conduct. Although the panel found respondent's conduct appalling, the panel recommended to this court a indefinite suspension with leave to apply for reinstatement after 1 year. The informant rejected that panel's recommendation because we believe that this case warrants disbarment or at least a 3-year suspension. This court has found that disbarment is the baseline sanction for the misappropriation of client property. The court's decision in the Ehler case makes clear that a lawyer's conversion of client funds to his own personal use is a disbarable offense. More recently, in the Ferris case in 2015, the court reaffirmed that disbarment is presumptively appropriate discipline when a lawyer knowingly converts client property and causes injury or potential injury to a client. There cannot be any doubt in this case that respondent caused actual injury to the individual clients who he represented, collected advance fee payments from, misappropriated funds, and performed no legal work. In addition, he caused potential injury to his clients by commingling personal funds in the trust account, thereby exposing the trust account funds to his many creditors. The ABA standards for imposing lawyer sanctions, on which this court normally and routinely relies, also support a disbarment in this case. Standard 4.11 provides that disbarment is appropriate when a lawyer knowingly converts client property and causes injury or potential injury to a client. There's no doubt that this was knowing misconduct. When you have that many withdrawals to cash from the trust accounts, 225, I think we can infer a knowledge. Secondly, the failure to have the records necessary that we were asking for to audit the accounts under the Ferris decision creates an inference of knowing misappropriation.
I believe his defense is that he had an alcohol and drug problem, gambling problem, which he now has under control, and that those are the cause. And is that why the panel recommended a 1-year suspension?
I believe so, Judge Stiff. And let me address the 5.285 mitigation issue, which is what was being relied on in this case by respondent. Respondent asks that claims that he suffers mental disorders within the meaning of 5.285. As you know, this court adopted that rule in 2010. Three requirements are necessary: a causal nexus between the mental disorders and the unethical conduct, the requirement the respondent have the ability to manage the mental disorders for a meaningful and sustained period of time, and that recurrence of the unethical conduct is unlikely. Respondent claims that the numerous instances of theft, dishonesty, neglect, lack of communication, unreasonable fees, lack of cooperation with our office, all resulted from his depression as well as his alcohol, drug, and gambling addictions. He claims that these conditions have been under control since August of 2015. Our belief is that that doesn't represent a sustained period of successful functioning and a meaningful period of successful functioning under Rule 5.285, and we don't believe that it should apply.
So what is sufficient, and have we ever addressed that? Does the rule have a minimum time in it?
There really is no time. It just and we didn't present any testimony, medical testimony, to say what a meaningful period would be. But we're talking about basically less than 2 years here, and our feeling is that that is not enough time for this person to have be able to claim mitigation under 5.285.
Is that and that may well make disbarment or 3-year suspension appropriate. It also could be something that's taken into consideration, of course, when if you're suspended for the lesser period, when they seek to be readmitted, whether they have demonstrated.
Certainly, through a readmittance process, he'd be subject to some very detailed and in-depth investigation of those issues. No doubt about it, Judge Stiff. Nevertheless, in our view,
if you're saying per se 2 years is never enough, or are you saying there's something about this case?
I think in this case, based on this court's decision in Bells, mm-hmm. the 3 years, if you're going to apply 5.285, and I haven't talked about all the aggravators, but there are more aggravators than mitigators, but let's get through this. And if we're going to apply 5.285, I think it should get Bell's treatment. In other words, in Bell's, the court took what was probably a disbarrable offense, reduced it to a three-year suspension based on bipolar disorder, the fact that he self-reported, which the court called an extremely significant mitigating factor, and the fact that he made restitution to the clients, full restitution. Two of those three mitigators aren't present here. If you give him the mental disorders, he still hasn't self-reported. In fact, there were 10 overdraft notifications. And secondly, he has not made restitution to all the clients that are out money. In my view, if you're going to treat this as a 5.285 mitigation situation, it should reduce the sanction from disbarment to an indefinite suspension with no leave to apply for reinstatement for 3 years, as occurred in the Bell's case. And to argue for anything less than that, as the panel did, I think they gave incorrect analysis to the 5.285 mitigator. I don't think this kind of misconduct can ever be mitigated down to a one-year suspension based on the mental disorders that he was suffering from, and in addition, whether or not there has been a sustained successful period of recovery. So in our view, what's called for here, frankly, and let me just mention in the minute I have left, the aggravators that we think are present. There's a dishonest and selfish motive, pattern of misconduct, multiple violations of the rules, bad faith, obstruction of the disciplinary proceeding, indifference to making restitution, substantial experience in the practice of law. In addition to his claim of 5.285 mitigation, there is no prior disciplinary history, and he has shown remorse at the disciplinary hearing panel hearing. In my view, even if you apply 5.285 and balance those aggravators against those mitigators, it still calls for disbarment. And I think the public is best protected by disbarment than it would be by any lesser period of suspension. So we are asking that the court enter an order disbarring the respondent from the practice of law.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I knew this was going to be a tough day this morning when the first fellow that got up here to argue was talking about the 1947 cases being too old to be considered. Let me say there isn't any question in this case that we have complied with Rule 5.285, and the testimony of Dr. Hutchinson was uncontroverted, uncontradicted, unrebutted, not attacked in any fashion. But the two things that I think played most prominently in this with the hearing panel were her testimony and Mr. McMillan's testimony. He came in and testified, and the hearing panel described the testimony that he gave, and they talked about a frank and open. And I would tell you, sitting there as his lawyer, he bared his soul, clearly he did. I mean, it was a full and complete, no equivocation, acknowledgement of what he had done. Really, I don't believe he came to acknowledge what he had done until he actually got drug and alcohol free. We know that he practiced in Missouri from 1998 to 2012, basically 14 years, with no disciplinary issues, no complaints. He apparently doing a fine job, had a good reputation and good practice. In 2012, things happened. He had been utilizing some alcohol without question and abusing alcohol that was functioning, as I've seen alcoholics who can function. But in 2012, he added cocaine to his substance abuse, and that's when the roof kind of caved in. And it was kind of interesting, this morning I was trying to find some reading of some kind that I could do that would prepare me to hopefully give a presentation on Mr. McMillan's behalf, that had some little different thoughts to it. I was thinking about having dealt with some of these issues with lawyers I'd had over the years, and I thought to look again at the provisions of Rule 1601 on substance abuse intervention. And it's an interesting situation. I was looking at 1601B, and interestingly, hadn't read it for a long time. 1601B, substance abuse causes or contributes to incompetence and malpractice of the law by lawyers and judges, which damages the public and the legal profession. Substance abusers neglect clients, violate rules of professional and judicial conduct, and commit crimes. Clearly that is a pretty good statement of what the risks are of being involved with that. And then it talks in 1601C that substance abuse is a disease. The provisions of 5.285 don't talk about that. It's a disorder, mental disorder. 1601 recognizes that it is a disease. Well, we know that Mr. McMillan had 14 years of productivity. He suffers and suffered then from diabetes, which is a family situation. He had clearly other members of his family who abused alcohol. He had high blood pressure, cholesterol numbers that were out of sight. Dr. Hutchinson indicated she thought as a result of that he was depressed and started self-treating himself for his depression with the use of these substances, and which was not a good choice, but a catastrophic choice. And she described his progression, and she very clearly indicated that this substance abuse, coupled with his depression, and also diagnosed him with an anxiety disorder and a personal condition that didn't relate. But she stated without equivocation that the mental disorders, the substance abuse, the depression, were the cause of his conduct, of his violation of the rules, of the professional misconduct. All of the things that Mr. Pratzel has talked about, she indicates, were the product of that. And if you look at what weight that's to be given in ABA Standards 922, it is entitled, when it's the sole cause, as she said it was, and she put it into a but-for analysis, but-for these conditions existing. We're not here. It's entitled to the greatest weight. So if we're going to weigh what the factors are, it's the one that it says is entitled to the greatest weight. She indicated he could practice. And what has happened with him was that in 2015, he had a cardiac event. Went to the hospital, very nearly died, had a near-death experience. And as I've told him a couple of times, it's probably the best thing that ever happened to him, because it enabled him to see where he was and that he needed to do something different with his life. And at that point, without any professional help, he stopped drinking and he stopped using substances. And he has been free ever since then. So he's now up to about 2 years. I would suppose that the panel assumed he was going to continue that way. That would put him at 3 years by the time he completed a period of probation, or excuse me, a period of suspension and with right to reapply. Mr. Pratzel suggests 3 years. 3 years would basically put him at four. And he is still substance-free and alcohol-free. He is in the position that he has addressed his diabetes. He's under treatment, but is not insulin-dependent. He was in 2016, diagnosed with sleep apnea, and he has now been treated for that, utilizes a CPAP. He's finding that he gets way more sleep, feels much better, has more energy, and is cognitively much better. And as all of us know, when you're sleep deprived, it not only affects you physically, it affects you mentally. There's a reason in interrogation techniques, people like to have you in a state of deprived sleep. He has managed his disease, and Dr. Hutchison described it as being in remission because he has done it. And so he continues in remission. His 2 years, a substantial management of the disease. There are no guidelines in the rule that say what it is, but it's certainly a heck of a lot more substantial than it was at the time the panel heard this, and hopefully it will continue to be. He has a good support system. The lady with whom he lives is very supportive of it, His parents are, or his mother is very supportive of him. He is getting along pretty well. He understands that he's going to be on the sidelines for some period of time. And he accepts that. He understands that. When I got up this morning, I was thinking, you know, this was a very experienced, very able, very qualified disciplinary hearing panel. They spent a lot of time on this. They heard this in August. They didn't hand down a decision until December. It took them almost 3.5 months, and I know they were kicking it around quite a bit. I am always happy that disciplinary hearing panels have lay members, because I think it gives great credence to the system to be able to say that a layperson was involved in the decision as to how this affects the public and the perception of the justice system and where we are with this. From the time this was filed, we have never denied what has occurred. He has admitted everything that he has done, and if you get the opportunity to read the transcript of what he had to say before the disciplinary hearing panel, I think you'll find it very enlightening. I don't think, sadly, that he really appreciated where he was until he had the cardiac event. Let's say, I think it's perhaps the best thing for him. I think there's good reason to follow what this hearing panel has found. It's a very well-written finding, and it looks at all the things that Mr. Pratzel talks about. His consequences of his conduct on his clients, what kind of person he is, who he is. The panel saw him at his barest, as far as I can say, and they noted that he had been a good practitioner for some period of time. They did not think disbarment was a thing, the answer. They realized that he's salvageable. He's proved in the past, with 14 years of practice, that he can do this. if he's substance-free and if he handles his difficulties in that area. The weight to be given to a panel decision is always an interesting question. You all are certainly free to accept, deny, do whatever you wish with the evidence and the findings. In this one, I would certainly urge you to follow this panel recommendation. It's well thought out by, say, veteran members who are well qualified, who've been on lots and lots of panels, none of them known as any kind of softies that I know of. And, I think it is certainly worthy of being adopted. There's a reason we have these panels, and the reason they put in their time, and the reason they make their analyses. And I think in this particular case, you know, the usual rule is they're entitled to considerable weight, I believe Donahoe said. You ought to be looking at this from the standpoint, is there some reason to go away from a panel decision rather than say, well, let's pick this apart. And I think it's entitled to that, and that would certainly ask you to adopt the panel decision. This is not a situation where he should never practice law again. Is it, were the offenses disbarrable? I would agree. Yeah, I think without question there. Particularly the trust account violations were situations that clearly would have been. But for the fact that in mitigation, his substance abuse, really alcohol abuse, is what took him down. So that would be our request. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Of course, the panel's decision, while it's given entitled to some weight, is also advisory in nature. It's up to this court to decide what the appropriate discipline is to protect the public and the integrity of the court. In my view, the panel's decision was well written. They just missed the boat on the sanction. They misanalyzed the remorse, the 5.285 analysis. I won't go into detail about Dr. Hutchison, except that she connected all the dots of 5.285. She read the answer to the amended information and made all the conclusions that she needed to make. She testified that these mental disorders were completely responsible for the misconduct. She testified that I don't think you'll ever see him again in the discipline system. But what I'm saying is the protection of the public calls for something more than simply a one-year suspension. I think we're not here to protect this respondent. We're here to do what is necessary to protect the public, and I would tell you that I think a one-year suspension is not adequate to protect the public from the serious misconduct that's occurred in this case. I will only point out the court's decision going back to Bells. And I'll just quote a short section from this decision. The court wrote, Judge Stith wrote, in a rare but appropriate case, a sanction other than disbarment may be appropriate for intentional misappropriation where mental illness is shown to have played a role in the misconduct and other substantial mitigating factors are present. And the fact is that other substantial mitigating factors are not present in this case, as they were in the Bells case. The factors that are present are outweighed by the aggravators that are present in the case. And for that reason, based on the numerous violations as to individual clients as well as trust accounts, we're asking that disbarment be issued and not a three-year suspension. But if the court decides that 5.285 is triggered, we think the appropriate mitigator is to a three-year suspension a la the Bells case. Thank you.
Case is submitted.